Welcome back to the Dobbies podcast. This episode is all about protecting our butterflies with butterfly conservation. I'm Louise Midgley and I'm delighted to be joined by a very special guest, Anthony McCluskey, who is the Helping Hands Project Officer at Butterfly Conservation. We're going to be chatting about creating gardens that help protect butterflies and moths and encourage them to thrive. I've really been looking forward to this chat, actually, Anthony, because I'm a moth enthusiast and butterfly enthusiast too, of course. So huge welcome.
Thanks for having me along to speak. We're really excited to launch this campaign with Dobbies.
Excellent. This year, Dobbies is the official partner of Butterfly Conservation, a collaboration aimed at highlighting the importance of gardening, sustainability and garden wildlife. Butterfly Conservation is the UK's only charity dedicated to the conservation of butterflies, moths and the environment, and they are asking everyone to consider various ways of creating a butterfly-friendly space in their gardens to help recover threatened species and increase numbers of these beautiful winged creatures. At this time of the year, it's wonderful to see butterflies and moths returning to our gardens, and there are easy ways to create safe havens for them to feed, breed and hibernate in our outdoor spaces, no matter what their size. But before we discuss this, Anthony, perhaps you could start by telling us about your role at Butterfly Conservation and a little bit more about the charity's fantastic work.
Yeah, so in Butterfly Conservation, I'm part of a project called Helping Hands for Butterflies, which is a project which works with volunteers mostly in Scotland to show them how to identify and record the butterflies that they see. And that really helps us to understand their populations and why they're declining and how we can help them. And we're also creating wildflower meadows in urban areas in Scotland, especially in parks. So we're helping to bring nature back into some of these really sometimes barren urban places. And that's what my role is around. And butterfly conservation widely, then we do work on several different levels to conserve butterflies and moths. We do that through our nature reserves, for example, or we'll work with farmers and other landowners. And we really want to encourage the public enjoyment of butterflies and moths through things like the Big Butterfly Count and initiatives to get the public out and spotting butterflies they see.
I always take part in the Big Butterfly Count. I absolutely love it. Last year, I don't think the figures were fantastic, and I'm absolutely sure I know why, because certainly down in the south, we had the most amazing weather from end of March onwards, and the butterflies came out really, really early. And by the time the butterfly count started, is it July, August? End of July, August?
That's right. It's usually the final 2 weeks in July and the first week in August.
Yeah. There seemed to be a bit of a gap because I was struggling to find butterflies. It's like they'd all flown and then there'd be a new set coming out after, you know, mid-August. So I think they missed a bit.
Yeah, that's right. And that's why we encourage monitoring throughout the year. So we have volunteers who go out every week recording the butterflies on certain routes called transects. And the big butterfly count is just a snapshot of a certain period. And so it's really affected by the weather. If we have an early spring, you might find that gap in the middle of summer because all of the early butterflies will come out first and then they will lay their eggs and their caterpillars will be feeding through the summer. And then you'll see them again at the end of summer when those caterpillars turn into adults. So sometimes there is just a bit of a gap where there isn't much else to see.
But have you always been passionate about butterflies and wildlife conservation? Did that inspire your career choice?
Wildlife generally, I always loved being outside. So whenever it came to me for choices about what to do with my life and when choosing university courses and such like, I decided I need to do something with living things. So I studied biology at university and then did a master's degree in ecology. And through that then, I began to study bumblebees. And I did my dissertation of bumblebees in orchards. So bumblebee pollination in orchards in County Armagh in Northern Ireland, where I'm from. So during that beautiful summer, I got to just get outside and learn all about bees, how they're pollinating the apples and making the fruit, but also the wildflowers that they feed upon and the different species. So I really deeply got into insects that way. And then after that, it was a more natural progression towards butterflies and moths. And so it's kind of a gateway. Many of us who work in conservation start with one thing and end up with another because there's so much to discover out there.
And I do remember the first time my uncle, when I was a child, pointed out bees on lavender. And I just thought they were bees. And he said, no, look, see how many different species you can find. And I was so surprised because then he taught me that there were solitary bees and bumblebees, honeybees, obviously just the one species of honeybees. But it was amazing when you actually look how many different varieties there are and how different they actually look.
Yeah, it's incredible. Whenever you begin to look at things closely, you know, your world has opened up so much, really, because as you say, there isn't just one type of bee. And that's a common misconception. We've got over 270 different species of bee in the UK, and they all nest in different places or feed upon different flowers. And they're all so interesting in their own rights. For me, it's an endless source of wonder and joy looking at these insects.
Oh, it really is. You just can't walk around with blinkers on. You've just got to stop and stare sometimes and just investigate. And it's widely agreed that butterflies and moths are sensitive indicators of the health of the environment. So could you explain to our listeners why it's so important we all support the conservation of these beautiful creatures?
Yeah, so they are very responsive, especially to things like climate change. And actually, we're seeing new species arriving in Scotland every few years now, possibly because of climate change helping more species to spread. So we know they're very sensitive indicators of climate and climate change, but also they're good indicators of how the environment generally is doing. If the insects at the bottom of the food chain aren't doing well, then the things which are higher up in the food chain won't be doing well either. So, for example, many birds will be feeding mostly upon insects. They might feed upon nuts and seeds in your garden in the winter, but in the summer they'll be trying to feed basically live meat to their young. So that can be caterpillars or spiders or little beasties like that. We know that whenever the invertebrates at the bottom of the food chain suffer, that it can really impact things higher up the food chain. And that's one of the reasons why we try to conserve them, because we're helping the whole ecosystem.
Of course. I mean, blue tits feed their young hundreds of caterpillars, I think, in a day.
Yeah, it can be up to 40,000 food items to raise one nest of blue tits. Each individual chick can eat about 100 kind of grubs and spiders and things per day. And if you have 10 chicks in a nest, that's 1,000 food items per day for one nest. So you can see the adults, the male and female, working together, going back and forth from the nest constantly. So, and again, really, even though I want to conserve as many butterflies and moths as possible, I also want to see more birds and bats. And I know that a lot of the food that I'll be eating are the things that I'm conserving, but I'm happy with that. I feel like there's an abundance. If you can have an abundance in your garden, everything wins.
Yes, it's a big diversity to aim for, isn't it? And which butterflies and moths are we likely to see in our gardens over spring and summer? And also, quite an important question, what's the easiest way to identify them? Because I don't think everybody knows the names of peacock butterflies, red admirals, even though they're very common, not everybody knows how to identify them yet.
Yeah, so to identify them, we have lots of resources on our website. So if you visit butterfly-conservation.org, there's some really useful ID help on it. And also through our social media channels, every month our social media team will be posting up what people could be seeing in their gardens. So that's a really easy way to stay informed about what's flying now. And we also have an app called iRecord Butterflies. So it's iRecord, which is all one word. And it's got a free butterfly ID guide with it, and you can also send in your sightings that way. And some of the most common species people will be seeing will be things like you mentioned, the peacock and small tortoiseshell, which the caterpillars of which actually feed upon nettles. And not everybody will have nettles in their garden, but there'll be a patch of nettles somewhere. And species like that are really good at flying, so they're quite big, they're quite strong. So they might come into your garden for a pit stop, really. You know, if you've got a buddleia or a sedum in your garden, they're just kind of stopping off, getting a drink of nectar to fuel them and fly on. And you'll also be seeing some of the white butterflies, and some of those aren't the favourite butterflies of gardeners, especially if you're growing cabbage or kale. There's the so-called cabbage whites, whose caterpillars do eat cabbages and kale and broccoli, and they're likely to be seen in gardens as well. And that includes the large white and the small white.
And I think also you can just take a photograph with your, if you're out and you've got your phone on you, most phones have got cameras now, take a picture and then it's easy to identify. That's exactly how I learned to identify all the butterflies in the woods and chalklands, which are different to the ones that you see in gardens.
Absolutely, that's a great idea. That's what I do. But also you can take a video. So if it's not working great, if you're finding it hard to get a single photo of a butterfly, take a video and then you can play it back and take a little screen grab of it or pause it, and you'll hopefully see the distinctive feature that you're after for that particular species.
Oh, that's a really good idea, because they don't always keep still, do they?
No.
Well, 3/4 of British butterfly species are in decline and a few have already become extinct. Which species are currently most at risk, and is there anything gardeners can do to help?
So the species which are most at risk are mostly found in particular habitats, things like you mentioned with the chalk grasslands, or particular habitats which are actually under threat, and therefore the butterflies are under threat too. But in our urban areas, we are seeing that butterflies are declining as well. Things like the small copper, which used to be found in many urban spots, are just disappearing because some places are maybe being tidied up a bit too much. You know, we're maybe being a bit fastidious when it comes to tidying up and, you know, getting rid of anything which we don't want to grow in the garden. So you can be growing some of the caterpillar food plants for those. So for small coppers, they just feed upon common sorrel, and they can be found in your garden if you have the right caterpillar plants for them. And people might also see the holly blues in their garden. Those holly blues caterpillars will feed upon holly and ivy. You often need to have both, because it has two broods per year. We can help species like that simply by providing the right caterpillar plants for them.
Perfect. And I think fewer people are using insecticide, which is all good news, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think there's been a real generational shift with pesticide. Certainly when I was growing up, the person who taught me how to garden, my granduncle, he was a professional gardener in a school, and he was very old school. He would have reached for the pesticide or herbicide right away to control things. Whereas now when I speak to young gardeners, they would absolutely balk at the idea of using chemicals just like that off the shelf. And I think there has been a real shift in people's mindsets when it comes to that, which is very, very welcome.
It's very positive. Yeah, I think in the olden days they had sheds full of insecticides or garage, you know, shelves full of insecticides. And now young people are very much into wildlife gardening and they love to grow wildflowers. Social media is just full of it, which is so encouraging. And Anthony, what would be your top tips and best advice for creating a butterfly-friendly garden?
So my top tips would be to know what they want. So for some butterflies, like the small tortoiseshell and peacock, which we mentioned, will be flying around gardens looking for nectar. First of all, get the nectar-rich plants, because you might not be able to have the caterpillar plants, but you can definitely have the nectar-rich plants. And most of those are, almost every flower that we get in garden centres has evolved to be pollinated by insects. So naturally, flowers are attractive to insects because the flower gets pollinated and the insect gets a food of pollen or nectar. So many of the plants in garden centres are already great for insects. So it's just choosing the right ones. And nectar-rich plants, for example, are well known. You've got Buddleia, for example, is a very, very well-known one. But almost everything you can get in a garden centre will be attractive to some insects, except sometimes the bedding plants have been, you know, selected and bred. So things like pansies and petunias, they've been bred to have really long lasting flowers, but maybe have less pollen and nectar. So we're really asking people to look for some of the more perennial plants. But also when you're out in the garden centre, look at what the insects are on, you know, let them tell you what to choose. And that's what I do. It's to think like an insect, you know, to go what they're after already. So that's what I do. And also to research the caterpillar plants. Now, you might not be able to get all of the rarest species in your garden, but there are some species which readily will breed in your garden if you have the right caterpillar plants. Not everybody wants to grow nettles. And if you do grow the nettles, you want to have them in a sunny position for the butterflies to lay their eggs upon. If you don't want them in your border, you could grow them in a big pot and you can move the pot around if you've got people around so they don't get stung. But also simple plants like nasturtium. If I was to grow a single plant for butterflies, it would be nasturtiums. Nasturtiums are great. You can eat the flowers, you can eat the leaves. Bumblebees visit the flowers for pollen and nectar. But then the white butterflies also lay their eggs upon them. So for me, nasturtiums are the ultimate simple plant to grow. You can grow them from seed, you can buy them as plug plants, and you can grow them anywhere as well. I've seen them growing in hanging baskets from second floor flats in cities, and still the butterflies are still on them and the eggs are on them. So it proves that they're very attractive to the butterflies.
Perfect. And nettles, you can just have them in a corner of the garden. You don't have to go near them, or you could even fence them off if you're worried about the children stinging themselves. But they're so invaluable because I think it's peacocks mainly, and small tortoiseshells lay their eggs on there. And I've got some at the end of my garden and it was literally smothered with these black caterpillars last year. I'm sure some of them got, well, most of them probably got eaten by the birds, but it's probably why I have so many peacock butterflies in my garden.
I agree. And what I tend to do in my garden is I have a patch in the border which has like a wire fence behind it. I let the nettles grow behind the wire fence where they're still getting a lot of sun. But then in front of them, I put vigorous plants so I can't go near them. So I put like hardy geraniums or crocosmia and things like that, that mean that the nettles are kept back and I'm never going to really touch them, and they're not in the front of the border, but they're still there for the butterflies when they need them. So I'm kind of working with them and not eliminating them, but also giving them their space too.
And so what other plants would be great for caterpillars where butterflies lay their eggs? I mean, nettles obviously, but shrubs and small trees and hedges.
Absolutely, especially for the moths in particular. So many of our moth species will actually just use some of the common hedgerow plants such as hawthorn or blackthorn or spindle as well. They'll lay their eggs upon those, but also just many of the trees, even cultivated types of birch or hazel. These can feed dozens of species of moth, and there are some moths which are quite generalist. They'll feed upon almost any shrub. So if you get something like a hazel or a birch, those are ideal because you will be getting many species on those.
And evergreen shrubs are great for giving them some protection from birds as well, so they can hide in there during the day, the night flying moths I'm talking about. That'll encourage them to stay in the garden, I expect.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, that structure is really important. You know, having a year-round structure is essential for moths and butterflies, because in the winter when we don't see them, most of them don't actually go underground. They remain above ground, either in their chrysalis or as an egg or a caterpillar, but they need somewhere to go and they can't just stay on the ground because it's too wet and it's too sodden. So many of them will just attach themselves onto a stem of a shrub through the winter. And even though they can be almost impossible for us to see, that's very often how they spend the winter. So actually having that year-round structure is essential. And also with hedgerows, you'll be getting things like bumblebees nesting at the base of them. And even birds will then nest in them too. So I'd definitely recommend getting a hedgerow, even if it's not got native plants in it. Some kind of a living hedge, I think, is a great addition to your garden.
So to live in and to feed from, it's vital, isn't it? Dobbies is the official partner of the Butterfly Conservation's Nurture for Nature campaign, which highlights the well-being benefits of spending time in a garden. Could you enlarge on this a little?
Yeah, so it's our new campaign because we find that many people really do take a lot from nature. So we find that spending time in nature is good for our mental health. And this has been supported by various studies through the years, which finds that, you know, actual measures of wellness, including, you know, our blood pressure and how calm and things we feel, are influenced greatly by our exposure to nature. That could be just going outside for a walk, but also staring intently at things. So actually paying attention to the wildlife around you, really looking at the bumblebees or the butterflies or other insects you see, really has a positive impact on our mental health and wellness. And so we want people to encourage more of that in their life, is to take care of themselves by taking care for nature.
And I think gardening also is fantastic physically, because you're bending and stretching and leaning over and doing all sorts of exercises. You don't even realise you're doing them.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's that movement thing. And you have to do it as well. That's the thing. You know, you could be, the garden tells you what needs done at certain times of year. So you might have an option some weekend to just sit on the couch and watch TV. But if there's a job needing done in the garden, it forces you to get out. And then when you're out, you know, it's fantastic. You breathe in the fresh air, getting some sunlight on your skin, which has been shown to increase vitamin D levels, which can affect our immunity and our bones and our teeth and things like that. So actually getting outside just generally is great for us. And there's been some studies as well on the benefits of soil. Just there's certain chemicals released by the bacteria in soil, and those have been shown to have a positive impact on our immune systems as well. So it's there for us, and all we have to do is go and experience it.
It's a win-win situation. And Anthony, what about people who only have a small garden? They might just have a balcony or a small patio. What can they do? Can they plant up pots for seasonal colour? What's the best way they can help butterflies and moths?
I grow a lot of plants from seeds for just that situation. I have a lot of pots and planters around the place, and those just get, they have bulbs which come back year after year. They have some main structure in them. I always grow extra seasonal plants for them as well. Just on my windowsill at the moment, I've got a whole host of things. I've got calendula and French marigolds and things coming up. I've got sunflower, viper's bugloss, and a whole host of things which do well in a single year. So it means that you're getting great colour. You're getting it for almost for free, just for the cost of a packet of seeds, and you can collect seeds and grow them on as well. So I definitely recommend that. And really, for a lot of people living in urban areas, it means that you don't have to just restrict yourself to what you can get from supermarkets or anything. For example, if you go to a garden centre, you can find seeds that will do extremely well just by growing on a windowsill, and then you can put them out and attract wildlife. And it's something I'd recommend, that even with the smallest space, you can still make a big difference. And also feed yourself from those. So things like Mediterranean herbs, like thyme, oregano, or rosemary, you could be using those in the kitchen. They all do extremely well in pots because they're drought tolerant, and you'll also be having the flowers on them that are then feeding the insects too. So again, it's a complete win-win when you're growing herbs like that in a smaller space.
Well, I think oregano is amazing for bees and for butterflies. It's like a real magnet, isn't it? Even when it grows wild in the countryside, it's fantastic.
It is, and it's actually one of the caterpillar plants of the mint moth. So the mint moth does lay its eggs upon mint, but it also lays its eggs upon oregano or marjoram. And so you can be getting this beautiful little jewel-like moth in your garden just by having that herb growing. So it's amazing that whenever you plant these things, everything else piles in.
And you don't have to plant all the seeds in the packet. You can just have a few of them and then keep the packet to next year, because sometimes there's loads and loads of seeds in a packet, hundreds of seeds in a packet. So just be careful how you plant them all.
Yeah, that's exactly what I do. I've got seed packets going back 4 or 5 years, and the germination rate does drop off over time, but I just sow more every year. And then, so if you sow twice as many and only half of those germinate, then you've still got, you know, a good supply of plants, and you can swap them with friends as well. And that's what I do. I'll put some seeds in the post to a friend and they'll send some to me. And it's a great way to share what you're doing and what works in different situations. So I think growing from seed is one of the most rewarding things that you can do as a gardener.
Later in the year, during autumn and winter, what about continuing to support butterflies and moths in our gardens? What can we do?
Yeah, so at that time, we almost need to do less around that time of year, because we need to be mindful of the fact that they're still there, even if we can't see them. So they go off somewhere. And for example, in my garden, I was growing a sweet rocket. So it's often known as Hesperus or Dame's Violet. So a really tall growing plant. It's a biennial. It's in the Brassica family. So it's attractive to the white butterflies. And last year I saw the green, faint white and orange tips that actually laid their eggs upon it. And so I saw them. I saw the caterpillars feeding. But then I noticed that they just disappeared. I thought they'd crawled off into a shrub nearby. Then when I was clearing away the dead seed heads at the end of the year, because it looks quite messy, I noticed a beautiful little thorn-like chrysalis of an orange tip butterfly. But if I had taken that away, if I had burned it or put it in the compost heap, that would have been killed. And I'm sure there are many more like that, you know, hidden away on the stems. So what I tend to do is I leave some stems standing through the winter, which creates a lovely effect as well. In a frosty day, you've got all those stems hanging up. But also I have quiet parts of my garden where I just stack stuff, you know, so I don't turn it into compost. If I'm pruning the hedge, for example, I'll take the prunings and just leave them somewhere under a tree or stack them somewhere so that they're not going to rot down too much. And that way you're not killing off the next generation. You're being mindful of the fact that it's still there and that you need to, you know, support it through that stage as well.
In sort of late autumn or even early spring, I've often found chrysalis in the soil or sometimes caterpillars crawling around. So it's just a good idea not to be too tidy in autumn, just to leave that stuff on the soil to die down naturally. I mean, take stuff off the lawn, but on the garden beds, perhaps just leave it and leave the seed heads as well.
That's exactly what I recommend. And actually, I find in my garden, I have to do so much less weeding because I leave stuff through the winter. So I'll just leave the hardy geraniums and such like for their leaves to fall down and rot. And they actually suppress the weed. So it's like a natural mulch. They're doing the kind of weeding work for me. And then in springtime, I just peel it off and the ground is bare underneath. And yeah, all those beasties have survived the winter, you know, tucked away underneath. And it means that I don't have to deal with shepherd's purse or annual weeds like that, which will just seed themselves really madly if you're constantly exposing the soil. So yeah, it's a way of saving yourself a bit more work.
Yeah, less labour intensive. That sounds like a really good option. Anthony, I think it's important to aim to have something in flower for as many months of the year as possible, because I often see a red admiral in late November or even at very early in the beginning of the year on a Daphne Bellua or a Viburnum bodnantense. So what would you suggest we plant for those off-peak seasons?
Yeah, for those butterflies, they actually survive the winter as adult butterflies and they will feed for as long as it's warm. So even until October and November, those butterflies are still feeding and they will actually take the nectar and they'll store the sugar from it as fat inside their bodies and they'll use it to get through the next few months before they come out, usually in March or April. So late on in the year, certainly I'd recommend some of the peak plants are things like the Michaelmas daisies, and you also have Sedum, Autumn Joy. So it's a fantastic one, which flowers quite late in the year. And Eupatorium is another very good one, usually flowering around September, October time. And they will get them through the end of the year, but also early on in the year, whenever they come out of hibernation. As soon as it gets warm again, those butterflies will emerge and they'll be starving. So they need to feed as soon as possible. Some of the autumn planting bulbs you could be doing for spring are things like Muscari. I'd highly recommend that. You know, the grape hyacinth, that's one I'd highly recommend. But also regular hyacinth as well is another really good one. And also the early flowering heathers. So many heathers flower in summertime, but you can get ones which flower very early on in the year. So it'll be some of the Erica carnea and Erica darliensis. Some species like that will be flowering. They're extremely hardy, so even if they get a frost down to -5 or anything, they will still flower in March and April, and they'll feed those early butterflies as soon as they come out of hibernation. So it's just important to consider butterflies really from early March until October normally, because they will be active during those times.
And some of the highly scented winter flowering shrubs are also quite good and really good for us as well. To have our gardens with beautiful winter flowering heathers and bulbs and flowering shrubs, it's amazing to look out of the window and not see a bland landscape, to see some colour for a change. It really does lift your spirits.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Things like the winter honeysuckle is another favourite of mine. On a warm south-facing wall on a winter's day, there's nothing like the scent of some of these winter shrubs to really just lift your spirits and hopefully feed the insects if they're active as well.
Great investment, definitely. Well, Anthony, thank you so much. We've talked about butterflies and moths and I think hopefully educated people about how to look after them a little bit more. But thank you so much for joining us. I hope we can chat again soon.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. And yeah, it's been great to chat.
A big thank you to everybody who's been listening. Be sure to visit the Butterfly Conservation website and follow them on social media to find out more about their fantastic work. And visit dobbies.com for more podcasts, advice and gardening inspiration. And stay tuned for the next Dobbies podcast, which is coming soon.